think what I want to do, I just want to, there's not very many people in here, but if anybody's listening out there, I just want to remind everybody to turn off your ringers on your cell phones. I'm one of the worst offenders of that, but it's just if you can turn off the ring so we just don't have to listen to that, that's fine. For the committee members, there's some files in your folder, and one of them is a save file. So if we put out any material that you want saved and kept in the file, just throw it in that save folder, and then the staff will hang on to it for you. We have some budget books here, and the budget books are don't have your names on them yet, and I think we're still compiling some of the material. So if you want to take it with you after the committee hearing is over, you may, but we'd kind of prefer you leave it here if you can, just for this meeting. And if you do take it with you, then you're responsible for bringing it back, and we're not going to be responsible for getting you another one. So for the next meetings, but we're going to recommend that you leave it here after this particular committee hearing is over, and then after that we'll do what you want with it. I'd like to start this hearing just by having the staff introduce themselves. The senators, I think everybody knows, and we know everybody as far as the senators are concerned, but maybe we just start over here with Cap, and you can introduce yourself so everybody knows who you are.
I am Cap O'Rourke. I am the committee administrator.
I'm Laura Bach. I'm the committee legislative assistant.
Dave Jensen, the fiscal analyst for the committee.
I'm Carol Baker. I'm the Senate counsel for the committee.
I'm Darlene Sliwa. I'm the legislative analyst for the committee.
Amanda Dewar with Senate Majority Research.
I'm Matt Sint. I'm the committee page for Senators Thomasoni and Vinson.
Okay. Thank you. Did we miss anybody?
Yeah.
All right. Today we've got the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, and they're a big part of this budget, and so we thought that we'd dedicate quite a bit of time to them. They're going to give us a little bit of overview of the Housing Finance Agency, and then maybe discuss some of the recommendations by the governor, and give us some numbers as far as the agency is concerned, and what we need to know about them. So, Mr. Marks, if you want to go ahead and start out, we'll be happy to hear from you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Tim Marks, and I'm very happy to be with you today. And I'm commissioner of the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, and I've held that position since 2003. There are a number of you who I have not met over the course of the last couple of years, and I know that me personally and all of us at Minnesota Housing look very much forward to working with you. There is a packet that we've provided for you in the right sleeve is a PowerPoint presentation that I'll be walking through, and on the left sleeve are some supplementary materials, including some budget materials that I'll be going over through the course of this presentation. Tanya Orr is our Assistant Commissioner for Housing Policy, and she will be back here in a moment, and I know that many of you know her, and she does most of our work up here at the legislature in terms of being our liaison. Just a bit about myself. I have been a lawyer in private.
One second. Sure. Just for the members, this might be a long presentation, and so if you have any questions in the middle of the presentation, go ahead and ask them, because I know that sometimes we go past the point and we forget what we want to ask. So go ahead and don't be afraid to interrupt us, Commissioner Marks, in the middle of the presentation if anything comes to mind. So I'm sorry.
Well, I will be very nimble and try to be responsive and, again, make this a discussion as much as you would like it. As I was saying, I've been a lawyer in the private practice for most of my career with Briggs & Morgan in St. Paul, and for another period of time was in public service as city attorney and deputy mayor for St. Paul. And our purpose here today is to give you a broad overview of the agency in this presentation and what our programs are and what our financing is. But we will also review with you in summary form the budget that has been proposed by the governor, the housing portion of it. We would very much like the opportunity to come back and talk in more detail about the budget as you get deeper into your deliberations. And in addition, we really like to offer you the opportunity to kind of see our work by taking some type of tour of the various developments that we have financed. Our agency and the programs can be pretty kind of technical are very finance-oriented, but when you see that it helps real people in your districts to have safe, decent, affordable housing, I think it will become more real for you. So we would invite you to take advantage of that opportunity. So what I will do is walk through this presentation with you, and again, stop me at any time if you have specific questions about any item. And this will probably take about a half hour or so in terms of the overall timing, depending upon the level of discussion. The first thing we'd like to do, or I do, is kind of talk about Minnesota's housing's record, what we've been up to for the last several years, then talk about the housing trends and challenges, and I'm on slide two right now, and then get more specifically into Minnesota Housing Finance Agency as an institution, talk about our mission and organization, our strategic goals, our program financing, and that's when I'll talk about the governor's proposed budget, and then the delivery of our programs. I'm turning over to slide three right now, and to give you an overview of what we've really accomplished over the last 4 years. In the last 4 years, I think we have done a great deal of work in challenging times to provide affordable housing throughout the state, and that is in part because we in the state have been very fortunate that there has been a long-term and bipartisan effort and support for affordable housing in Minnesota. That state government has been a part of, the federal government has been a part of, local government, the philanthropic and faith communities have all come together in a grand alliance that is very high functioning and knows how to get work done to develop a very good housing record for Minnesota. And the support from the legislature is very much a part of that and appreciated. And as a part of that, we can point to the highest homeownership rate in the country. And that, again, is a testament to the wealth creation that housing can provide.
Go ahead. I was pointing.
Okay. I've got a specific slide for Senator Saxog in here later, so I'm glad. In addition, we do a very good job in affordably housing our low-income citizens, and a very low percentage have a severe housing cost burden. Over the last 4 years, through the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, we've invested $2.7 billion of resources in affordable housing throughout the state. We have assisted over 227,000 households to achieve better housing for themselves and their families. And we've been a part of new construction, rehabilitation, or preservation of 30,000 housing units across the state. In addition, we've launched two major initiatives that really are nation-leading. One is the business plan to end long-term homelessness that has, again, received bipartisan support and broad support through the entire community. And second, an effort to increase minority homeownership throughout the state through the Emerging Market Homeownership Initiative. So, again, I think in tough fiscal times, we have done a good job of affordably housing Minnesotans and being on the forefront, and we look forward to better times in the future. On slide four right now, we have two basic type of programs. One is homeownership programs, and over the course of the last 6 years, we've invested $1.9 billion in homeownership programs, serving about 14,000 households per year, and that is primarily in low-cost mortgages and down payment assistance for first-time home buyers, as well as fix-up and rehabilitation programs and homeownership counseling and financial counseling, all those things that comprise successful long-term homeownership. Our second major area of program is our multifamily rental programs. About 41,000 households per year are served in this division of our agency. And again, $1.4 billion over the last 6 years in supportive housing for homeless and near homeless individuals and families, rental assistance, preservation, new construction, and also new development of multifamily housing throughout the state to keep up with the economic growth that is going throughout the state.
Commissioner,
so that in summary, it's a homeownership and multifamily are the major form of our programs, and that's on slide four.
Commissioner, these are income-sensitive programs, correct?
Very, very much so.
And is there going to be an explanation of the income levels where they qualify later on, or can you give us a quick brief of that?
And Mr. Chair, members, the next slide, slide five, gives you kind of a summary of the incomes that we serve. So if you look at the left column, kind of income comparisons, that kind of tells you where various income levels are in Minnesota. So the MFIP program serves families at about $10,000 level. The poverty level for a household of four is $20,000. The HUD non-metro median income is $55,000. 60% of HUD median statewide is $40,000. HUD median income, 60% of Minneapolis-St. Paul is $54,000. The HUD median income statewide is $68,000. And the HUD median income for Minneapolis and St. Paul is $78,000. That kind of gives you the range of incomes. And whom we serve primarily with our programs, if you see on the far right column, these are the median household incomes for those that we serve. So our median household income for the renters that we serve, again, very poor, just over $10,000, almost $11,000. Our first-time home buyers generally have a income of about $37,000 below the median, and our rehab programs, our fix-it-up programs, about $50,000. So we have a very good record of serving very low incomes. In terms of the gamut of whom we serve, and again, it's people with no income, homeless people on the streets that we try to get into housing, all the way up to moderate income families of up to about 115%, but most are focused in that 60 to 50% of median income area. That's our primary market.
And are these four people to a household, six people? I mean, is there a way to actually know how many people are being served in these households? Or
We base our programs on household income, so it is possible for some of our households to be up to four, and a lot of our households are larger families, and some of them programs also serve single. But we kind of focus on households, and you know the average household size in Minnesota is about 2.3, and the statistics don't necessarily break it down by the number of people in each household that we serve. But again, we have a very good record of it serving the very low income.
Okay, go ahead.
Just a brief review of one of the things.
Mr. Chair, I was just going to observe, with the exception of Senator Metzen, I think most of us sitting around this table would qualify for the first-time home buyer program.
So we would love to work with Senator Metzen too to make sure that the furnace is working.
He can help provide some of the loans.
Marx is a great American.
I don't know.
The next slide, slide six, I referred to the state's business plan to end long-term homelessness. And again, we would like the opportunity to go into more detail on it with you. And in the left side of your packet is a two-page summary of that plan. But I want to report to you that we have set specific benchmarks for that plan, and we have met those benchmarks or goals for the third year in a row. But we wanted to have committed financing for 1,000 units by the end of last year, and we've committed financing to 1,091 units by the end of last year. And these are the poorest of the poor, mentally ill, chemically dependent individuals on the streets that we are now serving. And in addition, we are under budget in terms of the capital costs that we have committed. So that is, I think, good news to report to you who are financing a significant portion of this plan. Moving to page 7, the slide 7, if you turn the page, just a couple of examples of the type of people who are served under the business plan to end long-term homelessness. Steve is a 59-year-old disabled veteran from Vietnam who had been on the streets in and around St. Paul for 19 years, is now housed because of this program and the support this legislature has provided. And so our work here is really also a veterans program. We do know that 16% of our long-term homeless individuals are veterans. Secondly, Sarah is a particular person that all of us have gotten to know who are working in this program, and she had been homeless on and off for 30 years and is now housed and getting her life together and becoming productive as a result of this plan. And again, that's why we encourage a tour. We'd like you to actually meet some of these people and understand the real human impact of what work that we are doing.
Commissioner, are these the stuff that's on the two-page summary?
Yes.
Is there any way of telling how they're divided up between rural and metro?
We can tell you that the long-term homeless, about 75% of the long-term homeless are located in the metropolitan area. About 47% are in Hennepin County. And the rest are dispersed throughout the state and in greater Minnesota. However, we have really good data about where their original homes were. And many of those who have migrated to the metro area did come from Greater Minnesota. That is their original home. And in terms of the units that are financed as a part of this plan, the 1,091 units, they are throughout the state. They are in Duluth and Moorhead and Apple Valley and throughout the entire metropolitan area. And we are making a conscious effort to have this be a statewide effort that is coming together for this effort.
So are we meeting the housing needs where the greatest number of greatest amount of need is? I mean, is the metro area getting the most of the money?
Under this plan, the long-term homeless business plan, the metro area is getting most of the money because that's where most of the homeless population are. But if you look at our entire housing budget for the entire $1.3 billion of our affordable housing plan, we do a very good job of equating and calibrating based upon eligible households and the percentage of eligible households in a particular region or city. They get roughly that equivalent amount in terms of the assistance that we need out. So we're very geographically balanced as an institution and try to meet the local needs where they are. So in Hennepin County, there are more homeless, and so we provide more resources for that need in Hennepin County. In Grand Rapids and Chisholm and in other places, it is more homes for working families, it is more single-family rehabilitation programs so seniors can stay in their homes. So we're very market-driven in how we approach our business.
Senator Olson.
Commissioner Thomas, Commissioner Marks, Mr. Chair. First, I'd just like to comment on your number in terms of the measure of 3,300 homeless people in the state. We have a homeless shelter in Bemidji that last year alone turned away 1,000 people, and that's a small community of population, maybe about 10,000, with a serving a community of about 40,000. And I've talked to the director of that homeless shelter, and one of the problems I think in underestimating the number of homeless in our state is how we are counting long-term homeless population. For example, if someone is staying with a friend, staying with another family member temporarily, going from home to home, that person isn't necessarily getting counted in your measurements, even though they are without a permanent home. And perhaps that's happening more in rural communities that tend to be more have maybe more family resources than in the metro area. But I would have to just, my comment would be that it seems to me that you are underestimating the number of homeless, perhaps especially in rural communities. And then my second comment would be that in the Bemidji area, and actually throughout my district, homelessness and lack of affordable housing has been identified to me as one of the biggest problems we have in our community. In the Bemidji area, some of that has to do with competition for housing by college students. But around the rest of the district, we have increasing property values, and yet we don't have people with increasing wages that can afford to keep up with people retiring into our area. So it's a really big problem in my district, and yet most of the housing being built is not for service of this population. It's for the higher-end housing population, and I'm wondering what we can do as a state to try to address that issue.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, first to your question on the homeless population and how we do the counting. Every 3 years, the state and philanthropic partners fund the Wilder Foundation to do a nation-leading comprehensive count of homelessness in Minnesota. And we'll be getting the results of their 2006 survey kind of sometime this year. But according to the 2003 survey, they kind of look at the homeless population in kind of three categories. The first is the biggest number, of which they estimate there are about 20,000 homeless or precariously housed. And the 20,000 homeless or precariously housed include that population that you referred to, which are kind of doubled up or on the verge of being homeless. The kind of hardcore homeless population, those who have spent some time or are on the streets without permanent shelter, is about 9,000. And then of that 9,000, there is about 3,300, according to the last Wilder survey, that are long-term homeless. And those who have been homeless for a year or more or have been episodically homeless several times over the last several years. This business plan specifically is targeted to those who are long-term homeless, that 3,300. And that's what this number is focused on. We recognize there are broader homeless population and there are those precariously housed, and we have services and programs that we finance across the entire kind of housing continuum, and we are specifically attuned to the situation of Bemidji. In fact, are working probably with the entities that you referred to figure out how we can address that specific situation in your community. I'd like to have a separate conversation with you about that, because some of the resources that were appropriated last year by this legislature, we'd like to figure out a way to use in Bemidji to address that specific problem. Secondly, on the other issue that you talked about, which is basically that housing prices are growing faster than incomes and wages. So we have that increasing affordability gap, and that is what our agency is trying to work on throughout the state with our financing programs to be able to help solve some of that gap. But there are all sorts of other policy policy implications of that affordability gap in terms of how much regulation do we put on in the building codes? How is zoning regulated or incented at the state? Are we having too large of lots and too large of streets that that incur infrastructure costs to get assessed to the home? There's all sorts of things that go into the cost of housing, and gap financing, either for the individual or for the developer, is one portion of it, but we think it's equally important to address the other portion of it as well. Even though it's not our specific job at Minnesota Housing, we see it as an issue and encourage the legislature to look at those issues.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I'd like to briefly talk about slide 8 right now. And that talks about our effort to increase minority homeownership in Minnesota. And we do have the highest homeownership rate in the nation overall, but that really masks a larger problem, which is we have the fifth largest gap between white homeownership and minority homeownership of any state in the country. Our homeownership for minority communities for emerging markets trails the national average. And we have developed with the homeownership industry, bankers and realtors, as well as nonprofits and community groups, a specific business plan or effort called the Emerging Market Homeownership Initiative to really develop new strategies to try to address that gap. And a summary of the Emerging Market Homeownership Initiative, which is now a new nonprofit organization of which we are a part, is also in the left hand of your packet. And our goal is 40,000 new minority homeowners by 2012, which will begin to close that gap. It'll raise, based upon how the demographics work, the minority homeownership rate to 58%. Still below the white homeownership rate, but good progress and moving things in the right direction. And again, this is an effort that is going to take many partners to come to the table to try to address. And we know that Minnesota is becoming more diverse. We know that homeownership is a means by which families create wealth that they educate their kids and they start businesses with. And we need to address that gap so that all Minnesotans have a good quality of life. And in addition, for those in the homeownership industry, they recognize this as a business issue. According to the National Association of Realtors, about 40% of new first-time homebuyers are emerging markets. And so they see this as a business opportunity as well. We're trying to bring this together from government and business and nonprofits to address this issue, again, on a statewide basis. What I'd like to shift to now is just talk about some current housing trends and challenges that are confronting Minnesota, beginning with slide 9. And slide 9, Senator Olson, really begins to talk to one of the issues that you raised, is that in 2000, 8% of Minnesota households had what we call severe cost burden, that is paying 50% or more of their income for housing. When the general standard you look to is anywhere between 30 and 35%. By 2005, again, because of housing prices growing faster than wages and incomes, that had increased to almost 12%. So we used to be eighth best in the nation, and now we're 12th in the nation. And that should be sending a little bit of signs to all of us that we have to concentrate on affordable housing in this state. That, again, is reflected in slide 10, where you see for the Twin Cities area, the ratio of median house price to median household income is increasing. Again, another demonstration of that affordability gap. And that's really a statewide phenomena as well. Moving to slide 12.
Commissioner, has the cost of housing in Minnesota, I know it's been a nationwide thing of late, but I know it's going down right now, but are these statistics a result of the fast increase of housing costs in the state, or is it just that the income is not keeping up with housing?
Mr. Chair, members, it's really the combination of the factors. So what you see is about housing construction costs rising at about 7% a year, and incomes have not been rising and wages have not been rising as fast, particularly for the low and moderate income brackets. In addition, you have the market dynamic, which was 3-4 years ago very hot, that we're pushing prices up beyond the 7% kind of construction margin, which is, again, moderating now. But there's still moderate increases, particularly in areas where there is growth. So what you see reflected here is a combination of those factors.
What's your house worth now? No.
Not as much.
No, go ahead.
Assessor has it.
Don't you have to ask him which one?
I've only seen one, so I don't know. Go ahead, Commissioner.
slide 11 really tells a lot of stories, and what we are showing in that slide are the impact for a family of making about $40,000 a year, $2,000 to $2,500 a month, what the impact is on their ability to afford other necessities if the price of housing for them increases. So you see in the far left bar for a family that is paying 30% or less for housing, they can spend $407 on transportation, $449 for food, $114 for health care, and $202 for personal insurance and pensions is how the consumer survey breaks it out. But as the proportion of your income that is devoted to housing goes up, it puts a squeeze on those other expenditures and your ability to pay for them. And here is a dynamic that we're seeing increasingly in Minnesota right now on a statewide basis, is that because of the fact that, and I'll use the metro area as an example, but this is a statewide phenomenon. Because we have most of the jobs growth for low and moderate income wage jobs are occurring in this region in the 494 to 694 strip, you see that most of the affordable housing available to those households are concentrated in the inner city or in the far exurbs, which means that you are placing a transportation cost burden on those households for them to get to where they work from where they live, and that many families are now paying 50, 60, and 70% of their income combined on housing and transportation because they have driven to qualify or live on the inner cities. And that is a severe burden for those working families, and it also burdens our transportation and transit system. Just one statistic I like to cite because it always has a little bit of a shock value is that the average Twin Cities family now spends more on transportation expenditures than the average Los Angeles family, which shows that we are de-densifying, that we have this jobs, housing, and transportation mismatch, and these figures show the impact on that. So for many working families, they are not able to pay as much for health care or food as they would otherwise be able to, because we do not have sufficient locational choice for housing throughout the region and throughout the state near where jobs are. And that's really the story of that slide.
Well, Commissioner, was that statistic about the Twin Cities and Los Angeles a percentage or was it a dollar amount?
It was a dollar figure. As a percentage, it's roughly equivalent, a little bit lower, but it's still very high in terms of national comparisons. And that was before... I guess I'm not sure where we are in gas prices now as to when that study was taken, but that was before the recent spike in gas prices as well. The next slide, slide 12, shows where we are in terms of rental vacancies and rental incomes. And what we see is that the housing market for rental is tightening and rents are going up. And generally what we see that the general market will have one vacancy rate, and for lower-end apartments, the vacancy rate is a little bit lower. So the market is usually a little bit tighter on the lower end, which is a demonstration, again, that for those at the affordable end, they're putting in a significant squeeze. So that kind of demonstrates, again, the affordability gap. Slide 13 is a map that we have from the Federal Reserve, and there's more current data, but the story is the same. We are seeing increased foreclosure rates throughout the state, throughout the Twin Cities region, and they are often concentrated in stressed neighborhoods, such as North Minneapolis and such as the east side of St. Paul. And that is a trend that we think merits paying attention to and having targeted public policy initiatives toward. And we know that the Department of Commerce will be having a proposal on this in terms of how they are looking at mortgage lending. We know that a task force has been formed in the Twin Cities by the Family Housing Fund that is going to be looking at this issue. And Minnesota Housing as well has programs in foreclosure prevention and foreclosure assistance that we are going to be beefing up as well under the proposed budget that we'll be presenting to you. But that's something that we need to pay targeted attention to, but also make sure that we understand the data so that we don't create more problems with our public policies, that we actually address the problem.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was wondering, I'm glad you mentioned the foreclosure issue because it occurred to me earlier in your presentation. Does the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency play any role in dealing with and addressing this issue, either in conjunction with or separate from Commerce and the Attorney General's office?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, first I want to assure you in terms of our own loan portfolio, our foreclosure rate and delinquency rate is very, very low. It's because we concentrate on successful homeownership. Our products are very good and we work on that. Yes, we do have a role to play in the foreclosure issue and are going to be a part of the task force that I mentioned that's being chaired by Elizabeth Ryan from the city of Minneapolis. And so, for example, we may be part of financing the acquisition of homes that have been foreclosed upon that are in danger of being turned into vacant property so that those get recycled back into new homeowners so that those neighborhoods don't deteriorate. So we may be a part of it in that way. Mm-hmm. Second, we do have a foreclosure prevention program that we fund counseling agencies so that there is a call for help when somebody is facing a delinquency so they know what to do. And through that program as well, homeowners can get temporary or loans from our agency that are deferred deferred so that they don't have to repay them until the house is sold as a temporary stopgap measure to get them through a couple of months or a job loss or a temporary situation.
Great. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, what I want to do is just kind of summarize slides 14, 15, and 16 for you and make the following points. We have been at Minnesota Housing in association with the Metropolitan Council, the Greater Minnesota Housing Fund, and others, a part of various studies over the last several years that really make the following points. First, Minnesota is still a growing state. We're one of the few states in the upper Midwest that is growing. For example, we are projected to grow by 2030 by 1.35 million people, or 27%. And anywhere from a half to a third of that household growth will be in the population or the income group that is 60% of median income or below, the $40,000 to $46,000 level that is eligible for assistance under our programs. And of those in that income level, the private sector will generally house and house affordably about half of that group, which means the remainder will need some form of housing assistance, broadly defined, some form of housing assistance, so that they can live a quality of life and so that the entire state has a better quality of life. So that's kind of the range of numbers that we would like to kind of leave you with. We're growing. A lot of that growth is in lower income households. About half of those will be served through the private market well, and where we come in and where other types of assistance programs come in is for that other remaining part of the population. And that brings me to kind of slide 17, which is an introduction to how we are viewing how perhaps we should be looking at housing and the state's role in housing and other communities' role in housing as we go forward for the next several years. And in the Minnesota map, and I'll talk about these more specifically later, are really the major efforts and programs that Minnesota Housing has to affordably house Minnesotans, from focusing on the homelessness issue to preserving housing to making sure that there is adequate housing for working families and providing gap financing. But what we have learned throughout the course of the last several years is that an affordably housed family and an affordably housed state really does have a dramatic impact on other quality of life factors that you as legislators and that really all Minnesotans care about. For example, if a family and a child is affordably housed and doesn't have excessive mobility between school and school, we know that the educational outcomes will be better than they otherwise would be. We also know that for an affordably housed child and family, that they are less likely to get sick. They are less likely to be hospitalized. And if we do housing well in terms of making it in a neighborhood that is walkable, that it will help actually to reduce obesity and other health problems. We also know, going back to that housing and transportation and jobs mismatch, that really a large part of our transportation problem in this state is a housing problem, because we have not done a good enough job at providing housing choices through all income levels dispersed throughout the state and region so that people don't have to get into that extra car and spend that extra money on gas. And so I urge you to think about part of our transportation problem is a housing problem, and other states and regions are beginning to review that. Going up the other part of it, housing is also a fiscal responsibility issue. If we do, Senator?
Do you have an idea how we fix that, though? Because it seems to me that nice houses are all in the same area, and then we have things we call ghettos or low housing. I mean, how do we bridge the gap of getting the people who have to travel to the place where the house is and at an income that is obviously causing them to live where they're living and driving to where they're driving.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if that was easy, I'm sure it would be done by now, but I'll give you some brief ideas that I ask you to consider as the legislative session in the next couple of years go by. We were part, and again, I'm going to focus this response on the metro area, but this is a issue. In doing a recent study of what affordable housing needs are for the metropolitan area, we discovered some dramatic instances where some communities had twice the number of jobs for low and moderate income workers than they did housing for low and moderate income workers. And if you look at the lot size requirements in those communities, if you look at the fees that are associated with developing housing in those communities, if you look at the local resources that are devoted to affordable housing in those communities, those are challenges that I think the region and the state needs to confront. In addition, if you look at the other state programs and resources that goes to those communities for transportation, for parks and open space, for environmental enhancements, they are not necessarily tied to incentives or programs that will encourage them to zone for and help finance affordable housing. Now, this can be a very controversial issue as you work with city councils who are very concerned about local control and for communities that are concerned about their neighborhoods. But there is really good evidence that affordable housing done well is not Cabrini Green, that it doesn't harm public safety, that it doesn't diminish property values, because these are people who are working in your schools, who are working at the McDonald's down the road, and if we are going to address comprehensively all of these other issues, it really is in the region's and state's interest to work better and think through strategies and work with local officials so that there is affordable housing choices. And I encourage you and your other committees in local government and education and environment to see where housing fits in so that we can incent this type of way and do it in a way that that is embraced by everybody, that is not a, that doesn't become a kind of push you, pull you debate. And we are certainly thinking of more strategies to encourage that and would encourage a lot of good thinking on that topic. And just finally, a couple more points. You know, if we develop more compactly, if we have perhaps in some neighborhoods narrower streets and adopt more of a fix-it-first strategy rather than a sprawling strategy, we can save a lot of money in terms of foregone infrastructure costs, foregone road costs, foregone sewer costs. So those, really, when you look at the state's fiscal picture, there is a strategy about doing housing better in terms of saving money over the long term. And we are very appreciative and supportive of all of the energy and environmental discussion that is a major issue in this legislature. But how we do housing in terms of the type of housing we build, and how we do housing as a community and locating it near green space and trying to do it so that we don't unnecessarily take up sensitive lands, those will all contribute significantly to meeting the energy and environmental goals that this legislature is going to be setting. And we would like to, again, have housing be a part of those discussions. And finally, housing is very important to a growing economy. Not only is housing a large portion of the economy, for example, some of the slowdown in the housing market is having a direct impact on the forest industry in northern Minnesota. So we do want a very robust and growing housing market. And even though affordable housing is a relatively small portion of the market, it does make a difference. When you invest resources in us, we then leverage that with all sorts of other private sector dollars that creates jobs and generates economic activity. And again, employers, particularly in a lot of the greater Minnesota communities, have really seen over the years housing being very important for their economic future and have invested themselves in affordable housing, and we have partnered with them. And for example, we have recently been in Grand Rapids where there may be a new steel plant and a new power plant where they're very concerned about what the housing impact for both the temporary workers and the permanent workers are as an economic development issue, and we'll very much be a part of those discussions in working with local officials and business officials up there.
We think it's a nice problem to have, actually.
Yes, I know. It's a great problem, but it's one we have to pay attention to.
Yep, you're right. Senator Dibble.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner Marks, I'm wondering, I loved what you had to say about the role of housing and how to make sure we have housing in the right places and that sort of thing. Wondering how often you talk to them at council, and if you could please talk to them some more. I recall we had some programs like that that have been summarily dismantled over the last few years. So, but seriously, how often are you in conversation with the Met Council about these very things?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, we are in regular conversation with the Metropolitan Council. In fact, we cooperated. They invited us into the recent study that looked at regional affordable housing needs, and we're jointly talking about that. They are a partner in a funding process that is managed through Minnesota Housing as a part of the Livable Communities Program. And we talk to them as we talk about where they're planning transit and where housing investments might be made. And I think we have recognized together that we could do a better job and want to do a better job, and not only between Minnesota Housing and Met Council, but between other state agencies as well, because, again, the environmental investments, the transportation on a statewide basis investments, all and the economic development investments could all be perhaps fit better together toward better statewide outcomes to accomplish the objectives that I talked about earlier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, we couldn't agree more with each other. I think, you know, no matter how we try to work through those mechanisms, whether it's through incentives or through regulation, everyone, you know, beats their chest and moans and bellyaches and says the Met Council is being coercive, just give me the money, and we don't care about the outcomes. By gosh, by golly, you know, put this road here and give us this economic development dollars and, you know, all these other sort of great public policy outcomes. Yeah, that's just a speech. Mr. Chair, I did have a question of Commissioner Marks. Could you go back for a second, Commissioner Marks, to slide 16 and just reiterate, because I didn't quite capture it, the level, the amount of housing we're going to need contrasted right. with the amount that's going to be need to be affordable, and of that, what the proportion is that is going to need some sort of public participation.
Okay. Slide 16 is the result of a recent study and analysis that we did with the Metropolitan Council that looked at Twin Cities regional needs for housing between 2011 and 2020. And again, the expected expansion of households during that period of time is about 166,000. Of that, 64,000 will be low-income households, 60% of median income, about $46,000 or less. And of that, the private market will probably take care and serve those households. There is an estimated need for 51,000 households that will receive, that will need new land, that will need land zoned for housing that can be affordable. And we can't say for sure whether that is going to, what type of assistance that will need. For the purposes of my response, I'm going to broadly define assistance to be beyond just financial assistance. But assistance might be zoning that is compact, that has higher densities, so that the square foot cost of housing is lower and more affordable. If local governments would do that and make land available at higher densities, close to transit, close to jobs, that is a form of assistance mm-hmm. that will be necessary for those 51,000 households. And some will need other financial assistance as well in terms of the financing that our agency and others provide.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, that's a tall order, just an observation that we're really going to have to get our heads and our policy minds around, and frankly, our dollars as well.
I like the way the commissioner's thinking anyway. How long it takes us to get there might be something, but at least we're looking at possible solutions. That's good.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What I'd like to shift to now is to talk more about Minnesota Housing Finance Agency now as an institution, beginning with page 18. We are your mission-driven housing financial institution. I'm committed to meeting Minnesotans' needs for safe, decent, and affordable housing. We do have a separate board as an agency with six members appointed by the governor, three from the metro area, no more than three from the metro area, no more than from one from any one economic development region outside the state. The state auditor serves an ex officio member, and it is their job to provide oversight and management to us. They meet on a monthly basis, and there will be two members reappointed by the governor that will be coming to you shortly. Slide 19, and if you look at the next page, it's a little bigger picture of our organization chart. Our board of directors, again, is the management entity. I report to the governor and serve on the governor's cabinet, and we're basically organized into four areas, starting on the far right, housing, finance, and operations. That's kind of the financial guts of the agency, and the technology raises the capital and the auditors and the finance function. Down the center, it's housing programs, the homes division, home ownership division, Mike Haley serving as assistant commissioner, multifamily division, Bob Odman serving as assistant commissioner, housing policy, assistant commissioner Tanya Orr, whom you all know and is our legislative director as well, and then our communications director, Megan Ryan. So that's kind of how we organize ourselves. We have about 200 employees, about 189 FTEs. Our operating budget is about $20 million, but we are self-funded. We don't look to the legislature for operating money. We earn money in the private market through the various fees and how we access the capital markets and earn money through that process. So we don't look to you for operating money. Page 20, the next slide, does talk about our strategic goals as they relate to ending long-term homelessness, increasing minority home ownership, preserving the existing affordable housing stock, increasing housing choices for workers, and the final one is to have us be a partner of choice for those who want to be a part of affordable housing. We think it's very important because housing is complicated. A housing transaction has multiple sources of funding, that we be as efficient and user-friendly as possible so that we can wring every affordable housing unit out of every dollar as possible. And I think we do have an excellent record in that regard. What I'd like to talk about now, and have you look to the pie charts on slide 21 and turn to the big one, which is to talk about our financial structure. And what these two pie charts represent over on the left is how we get our money, and the one on the right is how we spend or invest our money. And we do that in every 2 years. We adopt an affordable housing plan. And our total affordable housing plan for this current period is about $1.3 billion. And the largest source, that 51%, the green slice of the pie, is money that we raise through revenue bond sales in the private capital market. We are able, because the bonds are sold on a tax-exempt basis, to be able then to provide below-market financing to first-time homebuyers and developers doing multifamily projects. The next slice to the right of that is 27% are various federal resources that are allocated through our agency. That includes the housing tax credit. It includes home investment partnership funds and other funds that we get from the federal government, as well as administering contracts on behalf of the Housing and Urban Development Department at the federal level. The 14% figure are agency resources. Again, we are a financial institution. We earn money, and we are very good at and strategic about in taking the money that we earn and reinvesting it in housing. And so 14% of our resources, or this affordable housing plan, $177 million, are earnings that we redeploy in housing investments throughout the state. That last slice, the 8%, is what the state invests in affordable housing through our agency. And according to this biennial, that's about $105 million, and that includes the money through the capital bonding bill as well as through general fund appropriations. And even though that's the smallest slice, it is a very important slice because it's that slice that we use to provide zero-interest deferred loans that can provide soft second mortgages that really make a project or provide that down payment assistance that get that homeowner into the home. So even though small, its impact is much large. In fact, we could argue that $105 million helps to leverage the entire amount in the affordable housing plan of $1.3 billion, and we would suggest that's a pretty good leverage factor and return on investment. I'm going to talk a little bit about the use of the funds, then I'll take this opportunity to give you a briefing on the governor's proposed budget as it relates to housing. In terms of uses, again, 51% are in homeownership programs, as we talked about earlier. 25% is in rental portfolio management, and that's primarily funds that we receive from the Department of Housing and Urban Development to help manage many of their Section 8 projects throughout the state. 16% are in rental programs, and that's where you'll see, for example, the business plan to end long-term homelessness that comes out of that 16% slice, as well as other multifamily developments. The next slice, that 7%, is for home improvement programs. Housing preservation is a key priority. If you can preserve housing and not have to reinvest in it and build new housing and new infrastructure, it's very cost-effective, and we do that wherever possible. So that's a picture of our financing overall. In your packets is a little bit of a summary. It calls the governor's proposed housing budget.
Yep.
Commissioner,
yes.
You show that you're spending about $1.3 billion per biennium. How much of that goes to people under $20,000 of income? Do you have a percentage figure? Is it like 50% of that money goes to people under $20,000 of income, or is it 70%?
I don't know what. Well, I'll ask. Slide 32. Thank you. I do know the answer to that. If you go to slide 32. You'll see for this federal fiscal year that 41% of our resources go to those with incomes less than $9,000, and 34% go between 10 and 20, and on and up. So we have a really good record at serving the lowest incomes.
About 75%.
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Commissioner.
You should have in your packet a summary about the proposed housing budget for fiscal year 2008 and 2009. a couple of tables that go into some detail. And so I'll just spend some time going over the highlights of that. And if you want me to spend more time, I'd be happy to do it. And that's in the left sleeve of your packet. So if you have that, I can kind of summarize that for you. Yep, is that? I can't see that far, but it should say proposed budget. Yeah. And it has on the back side that map that I talked about earlier. I think everybody has it. Yep. Dave, you want to hold it up there and everybody will. Okay, everybody's got it.
Everybody's got one but me.
All
right. Okay.
Did you find one, Mr. Chair? We have some extras down here. Yeah. Okay. Okay. The major points are as follows. The governor's budget has recommends a 62% increase in our general fund appropriations over the appropriations that were provided in the 06-07 biennium for a total of $114 million. The governor is recommending the largest proposed base budget ever for Minnesota housing, nearly $90 million. All of our programs are recommended for an increase, and all of our programs, at minimum, will have their base budgets restored to the level of the biennium before the fiscal crises of these last two biennia. The second bullet.
Does that result in any hiring of any people, or is that just reinvesting in housing?
That is just reinvesting in housing. Again, we don't use any of the state-appropriated dollars for operations. We use all the state-appropriated dollars for programs. And over the last, in the 2000-2001 biennium, before my time at the agency, there was a significant amount of one-time resources or non-based resources that were appropriated to the agency out of TANF funds. And the agency at that time made a conscious decision not to staff up more. We probably worked harder, probably had some more consulting services, but didn't see that we needed to staff up to a significant level to spend these, to be able to invest well these resources. So with this proposed budget, I don't see that having a major impact on staffing at the agency, and even if it did, it's not going to come out of these resources.
Senator Corn.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, this is Mark said, and I just got back from when you talk about the previous bienniums, you're saying that this proposed budget goes back to the 02-03 budget? Is that?
What? Actually, if you want to go to a table that's on, there are two tables that accompany this presentation. And if you go to the back side, which says State Appropriations to Minnesota Housing, that provides you an historical summary of where appropriations have come to Minnesota Housing over the various biennia beginning in 1996 and 1997. And what the total proposal represented here, going to the far right, would be $114 million to Minnesota Housing. That is the governor's recommendation. And if you look at what occurred in the various biennia, that has gone up and down depending upon the level of non-base or one-time resources that were provided to the agency. If you look over at the second column, the base budget, you will see that what the governor has proposed in terms of base spending is the largest base budget ever for Minnesota housing. All of our programs have received some increase, some substantial increases divided between base and non-base. And the point I made, Senator Cohen, was that all of our programs, at minimum, are restored to the level of base funding in 2000-2001, before the fiscal crisis, or 2002-2003.
And I picked that up, and I'm glad you made reference to the this chart, because that lays out the numbers exactly for me. Because I just want, and this has nothing to do with yourself or with Governor Pawlenty, but I'll just mention, in comparing the 02-03 budget, in the 2001 session, I had a fairly significant increase. You know, that was the year of the huge surplus, and had a significant amount of non-base one-time funding. And in the end got none of that. So certainly I appreciate what Governor Plenty is suggesting with his 08-09 budget, but in terms of comparing everything to the 2001 budget, or the 2001 session, the 02-03 budget, it's not quite as rosy as you might suggest. And again, that's not a reflection on yourself or Governor Plenty at all. But there were many parts of the budget that got some significant increases, and obviously then got slashed with the 04-05 budget. But this one did not, and in fact, you can see that from the previous biennial budget. So the housing appropriations are still, there's still a long ways to go, before they catch up.
And Senator Olson.
Is there anything in Governor Pawlenty's budget that breaks this down by where it needs to go around the state geographically, or is that within your discretion or the discretion of your department, Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, I'll try to address both kind of comments or questions, and I'll start with yours, Senator Olson. The way that we provide our funding is we're a wholesale bank. We finance developers and deliver our products through lenders and nonprofit partners throughout the state. And we have what's called our consolidated RFP process that we conduct twice a year, that we bring all the funding partners together and ask for proposals from across the state, and then have a set of criteria that are in statute and in rule that try to meet out the resources based upon making sure there's a market for them and where they do meet various criteria that the legislature or we have established. Going back to those slides earlier that talked about where the growth in the state is occurring and where the affordable housing need is, it is a statewide need. And what we try to keep track of so that there's a rough equivalency over time is what, in a various region, for example, what percentage of the households in that region are eligible for housing assistance under our programs, and what percentage of our resources and how many resources actually went to that region. And over the years, we'll be pretty good, and we'll come and give you a separate briefing on this. We're pretty good at having a rough equivalency there between who's eligible and who gets the resources, because we are a statewide agency. We try to meet need on a statewide basis. Again, in various portions of the state, the need's a little bit different, where in areas that aren't growing as fast, the need is more for rehabilitation. For areas that are growing faster, it's for new construction. In areas where there is a homeless population, it is for perhaps more supportive housing. So we try to balance the entire continuum on a statewide basis. And I think have a pretty good record at it historically.
You wanted to comment?
Yeah, going to Senator Cohen's comment, it's always kind of a gentle balance when you kind of work through a budget process when there is money that is available on a one-time basis to make a case for that you are a good place for investing one-time money. And the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency is a place that can take and use non-base one-time money and invest it well, because you can see it in housing production and in housing loans. And I think we in the housing community and we at Minnesota Housing have to be careful that when we work with you and we work with the governor and the Department of Finance, when we talk about our use and ability to use one-time money, that we be clear that when there isn't one-time money available, we understand that we aren't making a claim necessarily to a long-term increase that you have to worry about having significant tails. So we very much appreciate non-base one-time money and can invest that when there are housing needs throughout the state. We appreciate that. We encourage that. And there will be times when we think we can predict based upon ongoing funding levels where there's an ongoing need. And you'll see as the governor's budget is constructed where there are non-base or one-time monies recommended, we can invest it and invest it well to get results. And if times are good, we may be suggesting that it could be converted to base, but we don't want to set you up for making that decision by accepting this one-time money and other programs where we think a base amount is justified and appropriate.
Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, and Commissioner Marks, my argument's not with yourself at all. I was just, you know, looking at those numbers, and let me make it clear that, that the money that I had appropriated, at that time I was chairman of state departments, which had the housing finance budget. It was more a throwback to the old state departments. But the new money was primarily one-time money.
Right.
Where it went was the rebate. But that's, you know, the Senate didn't have rebate money. House did. Governor wanted to do it. And that's where the money went.
Commissioner.
Okay,
did
what
you want to comment on that or no?
No, I think.
I didn't think you wanted to comment the last time either. But
stay out of that.
And before
I wasn't here then.
And before I go to Senator Dibble, Senator Olson, did you have a follow-up to yours? Because he gave a really long answer to your question, and so I don't know if you had a follow-up or not.
No, Mr. Chair, I didn't.
Okay, Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question about the numbers. I'm just trying to understand them a little better. Are these numbers, I'm looking at the kind of the history of appropriations.
Yes.
Are these indexed to inflation or are these nominal dollars?
Those are nominal dollars.
Thank you. Good.
And the $30 million in bonding, that's not there yet for the long-term homelessness. Are you going to be asking for that in the next legislative session? Is that what I'm looking at?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, over the last several years, as a part of the business plan in long-term homelessness, it suggests various capital budget amounts, and the legislature and the governor have been working together to appropriate those, and the business plan calls for $30 million for next year, and we will obviously be working through the capital process, but that's what's budgeted at least internally right now.
Okay. Do you have more?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
But you can, stop me.
No, we want you to.
Okay.
We got you here. We might as well have you go through it.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll go to the second bullet in the budget summary right now, where we are providing under the governor's budget significant new resources for homes for working families and the Challenge Fund, which is really our basic bread and butter funding program for workforce housing, is being recommended for a 70% increase to $36.8 million. And we want to use those resources throughout the state to finance housing projects and housing developments that try to address the transportation and environmental and education issues that we talked before. We will be coming back with language so that we are doing a good job of leveraging those resources and incenting contributions from local communities. And we also think these resources can be used to address emerging needs, whether it be manufactured home park preservation, emerging markets homeownership, or specialized community need. Third, this budget contains significant investments in the broad continuum of programs and resources that address the needs of the homeless or near homeless, including investments in the business plan to end long-term homelessness. Budget-wide, more than just Minnesota Housing, there's nearly $25 million of new investments that are proposed under this budget. As we worked and developed and began to implement the business plan, it was presumed that there would be good homeless prevention efforts, but we didn't, in the last two biennia, increase those efforts at the statewide funding level. This budget gives us the opportunity to do that, and this budget recommends a doubling of the Family Homeless Prevention Program, which is a nationwide recognized program where we fund counties and nonprofits that if somebody has lost a job, somebody has missed a mortgage payment, or is in some short-term crisis and they're at risk of showing up in a shelter, they get the help right away to prevent them from becoming homeless, and that's an important investment. Our Bridges program is being recommended for a $2 million increase. That is rental assistance for low-income persons who suffer from mental illness. The Housing Trust Fund is being recommended for a $9.5 million increase. That provides rental assistance and capital funds for very low-income families, including those who are homeless. 2 years ago, the legislature, at the recommendation of the governor, supported and adopted a $10 million service fund through DHS that was partnered and a part of the business plan to end long-term homelessness. That is being recommended for a $3.3 million increase. Through the DHS budget, transitional housing is being increased by $500,000. In addition, there's a prisoner reentry initiative through the Department of Corrections that's being funded at $3 million, and there's a housing component of that. And we think that's a very important initiative because a lot of those who are at risk of homeless or who are homeless are those who are coming out of prison. For example, one of the main addresses given for those who are leaving Stillwater is 1010 Curie in Minneapolis, which is a large homeless shelter. And we can do a lot to produce better outcomes for recently released offenders if we house them, get them jobs, and help them turn their lives around. That's an important initiative for this effort.
Commissioner, on the Bridges program, is there teeth in that? Are landlords required to rent to these people, or are they being turned away? How does this money actually get used?
Mr. Chair, members, what we do with all of our rental assistance programs is we provide those resources to counties and social service agencies like Lutheran Social Services, Hennepin County, Catholic Charities, and many others. And they develop relationships with landlords, sometimes master leases with landlords, and then go onto the streets or get referrals from social service agencies of people who need housing. And then they get a caseworker or somebody who helps them and places them with a landlord who will accept them. And what the landlord gets is regular rent. And also the landlord will do this because these can be challenging tenants because they know there is somebody behind the person who is being rented to in terms of a service provider. So if there is a problem, they know who to call so that tenant can be successful and the landlord's property can be protected. So it's that type of relationship.
Do we have anecdotal evidence of landlords refusing to rent to these people because of the mental illness? Does that become a problem for them?
Mr. Chair, I expect there are some landlords who just choose not to participate in the program. And we can't force landlords to participate in the program. But through the various social service agencies, they do a good job of letting the landlord know who they're getting and what type of client and tenant they're accepting. And a lot of landlords are long-term participants in these programs because they feel good about it. They're providing a service as well as getting regular rent. So a lot of times there are issues because landlords have a legitimate interest in protecting their property. So it's a negotiation and case management strategy to make these successful programs, but they are successful and have been for many years.
Okay. Mr. Chair. Senator Sparks.
Mr. Chair, just a quick question. Commissioner Marks, on the last initiative, the Prisoner Reentry Initiative, of which you're going to have a $750,000 pilot, have you designated those three counties that will be affected by that pilot?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sparks, that's a Department of Corrections initiative, and I believe that's an ongoing program, and I think the counties are Hennepin, Ramsey, and Olmsted, if I'm correct. Hennepin, Ramsey, and Olmsted.
Okay.
But again, this is a broader program, so there might be other opportunities, and Commissioner Fabian will be able to provide you more detail on that.
That's fine. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Let me follow up on that.
That was for Senator Sparks' information. That was an initiative that was in the Berglund bill last year. First time it was started, paid for with one-time money last year.
Okay.
So she may have more detail on that.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
I'm going to ask you to turn the page now to the second part of the budget summary sheet, where we have new investments proposed in housing preservation, including public housing. $2.5 million is being proposed for investments in the state's public housing stock that is owned and operated by public housing agencies in Minneapolis, Albert Lea, St. Paul, throughout the state. The federal government has been cutting dramatically funding to our public housing stock, both on a capital and operating basis. There are 22,000 units of public housing in the state that really serve very low-income households, many of whom are seniors and disabled. There are some public housing agencies that have been forced to sell some units, and we want to invest some state resources to shore up that stock as much as possible so that those folks don't end up on the streets. And it is a balancing act in putting a recommended amount in, because this has been a traditional federal responsibility that, quite frankly, they're falling back on. We don't think it should be a long-term state responsibility, and we want to invest enough to take care of the most crisis problems, but also send a message to our federal government that we need them to step up and return to their traditional role in supporting our traditional public housing. Secondly, we are recommending an increase of about $4.6 million in the single-family rehabilitation loan program. And we are really excited about the opportunity for those new resources. Again, this is a fix-it first housing preservation program. Money invested in preservation is much more cost-effective than money invested in new construction. This is a program that serves very low-income people, again, many seniors, that allows them to stay in their homes and out of nursing homes, which, as you know, is a significant state expense. The next category is homeownership opportunities. $1.7 million is recommended for investment in our homeownership assistance fund that provides resources for down payment assistance for first-time homebuyers. And we supplement that with agency resources to make that program go farther and be more effective. In addition, we are recommending an $820,000 increase in what's called our Homeownership Education Counseling and Training Program, or HECAT, and those resources will be targeted to our Emerging Markets Initiative and in areas that are getting significant foreclosures as a result of the significant increase of foreclosures throughout the state. Finally, we do our work through nonprofits and other delivery partners, and we are increasing our capacity building program where we work with nonprofits to ask them to develop proposals, provide capacity in the system so that we have a good delivery network that can make proposals to us, as well as fund items such as the Wilder Homelessness Survey so that we have good information throughout the state on what the housing market is, particularly for those who are of low income. The other summary sheet that is attached to the budget materials is a program-by-program summary of the appropriations that were a part of this of the budget for this biennium. The far right hand totals to the $114 million, and in the middle, it breaks down for you what is being recommended as a base increase and what is being recommended as a non-base increase so that you can see the breakout between the various budget categories. And what I'll do now, Mr. Chair, is just stop and see whether there's any more specific questions on the governor's proposed budget. We think this budget, if adopted, will make significant progress toward all of the issues that we were talking about earlier and are very proud to present this budget to you.
You know, real quickly, you've probably done this already, but real quickly, why don't you tell us what all these
programs are?
Acronyms are on the
list. Okay. Yes, that's a good idea. The Challenge Program is our bread and butter program that provides deferred loans primarily to developers and local governments to provide workforce housing. The PERF program is our preservation program. So it is through that program that we incent developers to stay in the federal Section 8 program and draw down those federal dollars, and that's where that public housing money will go as well. HTF is the Housing Trust Fund. That is primarily rental assistance and some capital dollars for supportive housing and for very low-income individuals. The FHPAP, that is the Family Homeless Prevention and Assistance Program. What I was talking about earlier is a nationally recognized program that provides assistance to families who are at risk of homelessness. That is being recommended for a doubling of resources. The Rehab Loans Program are single-family rehabilitation deferred loans for very low-income families. The Bridges Program is a rental assistance program targeted to those experiencing mental illness. The HECAT Program is the Homeownership Education and Counseling Program that provides foreclosure assistance, that provides financial counseling and other assistance for successful homeownership. The Capacity Building Program are grants to nonprofits to strengthening the affordable housing development network, delivery network throughout the state. And half is the Homeownership Assistance Fund, which provides down payment and other assistance to first-time homebuyers.
Okay, that works. Now, Commissioner, some of this non-base stuff, is any of it similar to a revolving loan fund that once you invest it, it just kind of keeps coming back and you kind of keep reinvesting it, or is it spent once and then we're done with it?
Except for the HECAT program and the capacity building program, it is all deferred loan money, or primarily deferred loan money. The HECAT and capacity building is primarily grant money that won't come back. So, for example, I'll use the challenge program as an example, where a development in Grand Rapids, a multifamily developer, in order to keep the rents low enough, needs $300,000 of assistance to help build the project and keep the rents affordable. We will provide that $300,000 in terms of a deferred loan, have a mortgage on the property, which requires them to meet the rent restrictions that they agree to, and over the course, and then that those loans generally have a 20 or sometimes 30-year term. At the end of 20 or 30 years, or if they sell the property and they are not meeting the affordability restrictions, that money does come back to the agency and is recycled. But because it is deferred money, many times many years out, it's coming back is sometimes speculative. And many times what we will do after 20 or 30 years is recapitalize it with new money so that they will maintain it in the affordable housing stock.
Are there any questions of the commissioner before we – do you have anything further?
I can go into more detail about all of the programs and have more presentation for you, but I can also be respectful of your time and energy and wrap up. So whatever your pleasure is.
We have more time, but I think, you know, we're getting we're probably going to have you go over a budget document.
Right.
And we'll probably wait until we get an actual bill in front of us and so we can take a look at it. So maybe at that would be unless the committee would like to sit here a little bit longer and listen. I'm not sure. But Senator Dibble,
I'd like
I think
to go
maybe
till
we'll
five
do is,
if we can.
Senator Dibble.
I'll take them on.
So I think maybe what we'll do, Commissioner, is unless somebody has some more questions, and does anybody want to make any comments from the audience? I think the commissioner did a pretty good job of covering what's going on as far as the nuts and bolts of the situation are here. And what we're probably going to do as a committee is we'll be hearing more in-depth budget presentations and go through the budget book and actually look at the numbers a little bit closer and compile a committee bill. And then we'll see if we can get our leadership to agree with us and the numbers that we stick in it, and then we'll go from there. So, Senator Dibble.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Great comment. I pledge my effort to help convince our leadership on that. I just want to say I think it's a remarkable budget, and I commend the commissioner. We'll, of course, you know, be getting into details, and I'll be very interested, of course, in looking at the need versus the resource that's made available. But it's a heck of a lot better budget than we've been dealing with in this particular area in a number of years. So it's definitely something we can work with.
You made a comment that we're back up to the base of, 2001, 2002. Is there – how far away are we from being there if we added inflation to it? Just have you had that – have you calculated that, or is that in there somewhere?
Mr. Chair, members, we have not calculated that. That's something we could try to figure out and provide some information on as you go through your deliberations. But again, since we don't use money for operating purposes, that's not as relevant to us. We think this is a very healthy increase in our budget and gets us in a position to deliver a lot of product for Minnesotans. And what we have to be concerned about in terms of inflation is that gap we talked about earlier with housing prices rising faster than incomes, and make sure that we have sufficient resources to help Minnesotans address that gap where appropriate.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner, I would be interested in looking at that comparison or that study, not just with respect to average inflation, but with respect specifically to the increase in costs in the housing market, to see how far behind we still are in keeping up with those increases in costs.
Okay. Senator Dibble.
One final comment, Mr. Chair. Thanks. So in the last committee I was in, they talked about how if we do the right thing with respect to some of these conservation dollars that might be made available, we can avoid building water treatment plants before the water filters into the streams and creeks of Minnesota. So I'm super interested in working with the agency more closely on some of these larger policy issues that we touched on earlier, so that maybe we address some of these issues before we have to shove a lot of capital dollars into housing people. So that's more of a qualitative area, less a dollar area, that I also think we could spend some time on.
Okay. Anything else? Any announcements that we know of right now? No? Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much, Commissioner. I appreciate it. We'll be in touch, and we'll hear you again, and meeting adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Appreciate the time and attention.
I'll just hang on to these for you.
Come to my office.
Okay.
Nail down that data.
Pretty excellent.